Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 494, another interview with Daniel Hopsicker about electoral fraud. This has been recorded on January 9th of the year 2005. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring to our airwaves Daniel Hopsicker. Daniel, welcome back once again.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, things are certainly looking interesting as we head into the year of our Lord 2005, as we observe that the Ukraine is blossoming with electoral democratic flower. And unfortunately, the same can't be said here of the United States and the sovereign state of Florida. You've been covering things rotten in Denmark, although one could transpose Denmark for the USA in this context. You've done a number of articles about electoral fraud, linking electronic voting with organized crime, with people involved with the federal government, people involved with Florida government, and people involved with federal and Florida government and organized crime and all kinds of other things, and evidentiary tributaries running between this concatenation and September 11th. What I'd like to do in this interview, because we've touched on some of this information, is to fill in some of the background of some of your older articles about election fraud and then trace some of these things forward into what's been going on down there in Florida and some of the things that we have breaking on around us. We've been discussing both in the interviews that I've done with you, Daniel, and in some of the past programs about election fraud. We've talked about a number of companies that intersect with one another. We've talked in the past, I've spoken on the show about Diebold, its relationship with a company called ES&S, how ES&S absorbed Business Records Corporation out of Dallas, Texas, a Hunt-financed company. And then, in turn, we've been linking these companies with a company that you have been focusing on to a large extent, a company called Sequoia. I'd like to examine how some of these things flow together. Let me just briefly encapsulate some of the things we've spoken about in the past. Sequoia Voting Systems has an interesting history. It began as a spin-off from Rockwell Corporation, and in that regard, a guy named Lloyd Dixon, one of the early officials with what became Sequoia, eventually wound up doing time for bribing officials in Buffalo, New York. That heritage was then carried on forward when a guy named Lewis Wolfson, also involved with Sequoia, was convicted of attempting to bribe then U.S. Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas. You've also noted that among the people representing Sequoia Election Systems are people like Salvatore Reale, a Gambino lieutenant who was active on behalf of Sequoia in New York. And then you opened up a can of worms down in, investigatively speaking, down in Nolens in Louisiana. And there are a number of interesting tributaries running across the south over into Florida. And I'd like to check some of those things out now and see if I can't see if we can't trace this on into Florida and some of the things that we see in some of your more recent articles. New Orleans, Jerry Fowler, Las Vegas, and Harrah's. How do those things hook up? How did Mr. Fowler run afoul, so to speak, of the authorities down in New Orleans? And how does this tie in with Sequoia and Pasquale Rocco Risi?
Well, what an interesting question.
In 25 words or less.
What a large topic.
Yep.
The 2000 election happened, and I wondered, how did it happen? And read a newspaper because I was in the New Orleans newspaper because I was living in outside New Orleans waiting for my first book to come out, which had been written about a Louisiana CIA official.
That, by the way, is the book Barry and the Boys about Barry Seal. Go ahead.
Right. So I'm just reading the paper one morning, sipping coffee, and I look below the fold, and here's a story about the Commissioner of Elections being convicted of accepting bribes for a period of over a decade. Something I had never even heard about before. So I thought, well, how might this affect, what does this have to do with the election that's just happened? And began pursuing this story and discovered some really interesting things. One of the most interesting things I discovered was that although the commissioner of elections for the state of Louisiana was convicted of accepting bribes for over a decade from Sequoia Pacific, the name of the corporate, the name of the company was never once mentioned anywhere in the Louisiana press, not once.
Okay.
So, I mean, how big and powerful do you have to be to keep your names, keep your name out of the papers when your company has been accused and it's been proven that your company has been bribing a public official for a decade? Ask yourself that. I mean, how powerful do you have to be before the name of the company that bribed this guy for a decade doesn't even make the papers?
You got to be big. You've got to have connections, and certainly Sequoia has a lot of connections. One of the things we should note simply in passing is that Jerry Fowler had run up a lot of debt at Harrah's in Las Vegas, and then down in New Orleans there was a move to open a Harrah's down there. The there were ballots, and that brings us to what was foul in the fair lands of Louisiana.
Right, that's how Fowler got caught. There was a gambling initiative down there where the election-related fraud became particularly egregious because the gambling interests that wanted a casino in New Orleans had a lot at stake. And so Fowler, so the fraud became apparent in the 96 election and actually was brought to light, you may or may not be happy to learn, by a couple of local Republican candidates who were amazed at how the election had been stolen.
One of those was Woody Jenkins.
Yeah, Woody Jenkins, who's a buddy of Oliver North, of all things, apparently. Or, you know, who knows how far back that goes. But he seemed like a decent enough sort when I met him. You know, he's the traditional representative of a party that is never in power, you know. So, I mean, in a state where the Republicans have been in power for decades, you know, the Democrats tend to be a little more honest than they are, when they're in power back and forth. And so Jenkins, you know, knew going into the election that he was going to lose, but the fraud was so egregious that he and a local candidate pointed it out. So the fraud became apparent, I think, is the point you want to get to, because of a gambling initiative in New Orleans.
Right. We should note, traditionally, the Deep South, New Orleans, and others had been Democratic. Now they're going Republican, though. Now the Republicans are taking over what had been known by political scientists as the Solid South. So we've got Jerry Fowler. He runs up gambling debts at Harrah's in Las Vegas. And that brings us to a gambling initiative in Florida. What happened there with Mr. Fowler?
You mean the gambling initiative in Florida?
Gambling initiative in Louisiana. Excuse me, I'm jumping ahead because then we see some of these same interests functioning in analogous contexts in Florida. But yet in New Orleans, we've got Fowler. He's in debt to Harrah's. There's a gambling initiative on the ballot down there. What happened then?
Well, nothing happened then. Fowler got indicted, convicted. Testimony revealed that the fraud was directed by the Southeast representatives of Sequoia Pacific, one of whom was indicted but not convicted, Phil Foster, and whose brother-in-law was deeply implicated in the scheme. So how Phil Foster could not have been implicated in it is beyond any sort of logic. And the other, the main Southeast representative for the second largest election services company in this country, was a guy by the name of Pasquale Rocco Risi from Marlton, New Jersey, who was for the crime of subverting democracy in the sovereign state of Louisiana for a decade, was given a sentence of 1 year, 1 year of home detention.
I bet that learned him, huh?
Yeah, I imagine it did. But, well, of course, he was allowed to serve his year of home detention in his Marlton, New Jersey mansion, which looks no more convenient than the mansion he lived in Baton Rouge, which used to belong to Jimmy Swaggart. But for some reason, he wanted to be closer to home. So, you know, that's when I began. So this is all I learned all of this within 6 weeks after the 2000 election, because on the night of the 2000 election, I was shooting a documentary based on allegations by some wacky friends of mine that American elections are not as open and honest as we all know them to be.
Mm-hmm. we should add briefly that Harris, one of the central bones of contention in the Louisiana Gambling Initiative was that Harris was going to be opening up in New Orleans, and of course that was the institution at which Jerry Fowler got himself into trouble to begin with.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to knock that point totally on the head. Poor Mr. Fowler will be getting out of jail soon.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I'm simply noting because actually.
Well, here's something you don't know that I didn't know until last week about that. One of the actors in the 2004 drama that we're really here to discuss, Adnan Khashoggi, I just discovered, was also his casino proposal. He had passed money to Fowler for his casino proposal, but his name was never mentioned because the Missouri Gaming Company, which he secretly owned, was mentioned, but they never got to Adnan Khashoggi on it. So the two big fish in this major drama never made the papers, Adnan Khashoggi and Sequoia Pacific.
Fascinating. Well, Khashoggi figures in some of the goings-on in Florida and elsewhere. We'll come to Khashoggi in a minute. Before we leave Louisiana, and again, I want to note that Phil Foster, one of the top executives with Sequoia and a guy who is involved at Birmingham, Alabama, at the same time as a guy named Richard Clark showed up in Birmingham. We'll try to tie that together in a couple of minutes. But before we leave New Orleans, where Jerry Fowler gets into trouble in Las Vegas, that appears to put a leash on him. Sequoia then is able to manipulate that, apparently using Pasquale Roccorisi. Tell us about Susan Bernacker, and tell us about the late Tony Giambaluca.
Tony, yeah, okay, well, sadly, in America, well, I mean, there's it's never a real scandal, you know, until the bodies start to pile up. And the supervisor of elections for New Orleans Parish turned up suicided behind a dumpster weeks before the election. He obviously displeased someone in some fashion. And then Susan Bernacker, bless her little heart, was a Republican candidate for city council in New Orleans, and had all kinds of indications that she was winning her district. And then on the day of the election, she lost by a huge margin to a guy named Nick Giambaluca. His relationship with Tony, the deceased Tony Giambaluca, is unknown. But Susan, being the nice thing about Americans is that, I mean, we're clueless, usually. Most of us are clueless. But, you know, when people do find out about things, they take it on themselves to make things right, which is that spirit of individual initiative that is lacking in Europe. And so as a matter of law, candidates are allowed to witness the opening of the electronic voting machines, the voting machines, period, in the election warehouse 3 days after the election. And the tally on each machine is visible. So she went to the warehouse where they kept the machines, and this is where the election was fixed, right in New Orleans, or at least where the totals looked so non-logical that the strong suspicion is that's where the votes came in. She was allowed to test the machines, and to her horror, she brought a cameraman, okay? That's what's so neat about her, okay? She brought a cameraman with her. So he was there rolling when she's testing the machine, and she presses her name, you know, Susan Bernacker, and the machine reads a vote for her opponent, Nick Giambaluca. And she does it again, and it happens again. And she moved around to 3-4 machines, and, you know, 2 times out of 3, when she pressed Susan Bernacker, a vote was registered for Nick Giambaluca, and she has it on video, and it's prima facie. How do you say that? Prima facie?
I've always said prima facie.
Prima facie works for me. I was never much on Latin. Prima facie proof that voting machines can be simply fixed and in R on a regular basis.
And I'm interested in this. So Nick Giambaluca was her opponent. That in one of your articles you said pressing Bernacker and getting Giambaluca, and that's a reference to Nick Giambaluca.
Right.
Who was her opponent? And
Tony's already dead by now.
Tony's dead. He's the New Orleans election supervisor. A couple of weeks before the election, he turns up shot through the head behind a dumpster and alleged suicide. But as yet, the relationship, if any, between Nick and Tony has not established.
Well, I don't remember if I looked into it, the Giambalucas of New Orleans, who knows, you know, and it wasn't the focus of what I was doing.
Yeah, certainly is an interesting coincidence if there isn't more to it. But now, again, gambling is one of the things that is a common thread in what we've been looking at in New Orleans. Now, Daniel, of course, you're in Florida. There's been a lot of focus on election fraud in Florida in 2000, 2002, 2004. Let me just briefly try to sum up some of the stuff that we've looked at, and then we're going to carry this gambling thread, so to speak, from New Orleans and Louisiana over into Florida, because it dovetails with some of the shenanigans there. Obviously, people are familiar with the 2000 vote controversy. Catherine Harris, Secretary of State for Florida, helps to shut that down. She then gets elected to Congress herself. And as you noted, Catherine Harris was one of the people who provided a celebrity endorsement for some of these bogus airlines owned by people like Rudy Deckers, you know, specifically Florida Air, owned by Rudy Deckers and Wally Hilliard, two of the people who owned the, quote, flight schools, unquote, through which the 9/11 hijackers were able to not only infiltrate the U.S. but remain untouched. In the 2002 and 2004 elections, you've noted that a woman named Deborah Clark, appointed by Jeb Bush to be head of elections in Pinellas County. Am I pronouncing that right? P-I-N-E-L-L-A-S?
Correct.
Pinellas County, Florida. Well, she's appointed by Jeb Bush, and it turns out that there was a key gambling initiative on the ballot in Florida in 2004. Tell us what happened with Deborah Clark, again, Jeb Bush's protege, and this gambling initiative. Because once again, we see some highly irregular vote situations vis-a-vis the 2004 Florida gambling initiative.
Yeah, I'm sorry you brought this up, because it upsets me to have to talk about it. Let me put this to you just in one sentence, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere in the national media have you heard that except for a supposedly bonehead mistake by Deborah Clark, the supervisor of elections in Pinellas County, we would have gotten a recount of the Florida vote.
Interesting. Well, you write here, and the article, by the way, is titled Fraud by Computer in Florida, dated December 14th of last year, that the voting initiative actually lost by 17,000 votes. But you write here that Deborah Clark provided an extra 34,000 votes on the yes side of the gambling initiative. How does somebody do that? I mean, how do you just, well, here's 34,000 extra votes. That's a neat little trick. How did that happen?
Well, I'm going to tell you, okay?
Uh-huh.
The explanation she gave for the phony figures that she submitted, and which were accepted by the state of Florida, and which were used to prevent a recount, the explanation she gave for that is the same explanation that I have seen given in, three, four, maybe as many as a half a dozen other localities. When fraud is exposed, this is the explanation that they come up with. So it must be, you know, if anything happens, just tell them that we had too many votes in that precinct, that the machine is only programmed to count up to 32,000 and then begins to count down from 32,000. The explanation makes no sense at all.
It would certainly seem that the explanation would be a very good argument in favor of paper ballots, you know?
I'm getting increasingly upset.
Well, it is.
Wait. No. I mean, in the footage last week of the glorious democratic revolution in the Ukraine, okay, the second ballot that everyone agrees was completely free of fraud, okay, people are shown putting paper ballots into clear plastic transparent boxes, okay, paper ballots which can be counted and recounted at will.
Mm-hmm. Same system is used up in Canada, our northern neighbor. It works just fine.
It's when you see something, I mean, every computer, I'm not being too strong here, I don't think, when I say that every computer expert I have seen interviewed on the way we vote here in the U.S. throws up his hands and says it's open to fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we get no national press on the subject, even from the Democratic Party.
Well, one of the things that we've noted,
Democrats are all about, you know, not enough machines in the precinct, people waiting for four hours, there was minority intimidation, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's all fine and good, and I'm sure it's all true, but, like, they never point a finger at the real problem, which is that there's not, which is that of the half a dozen election companies that count our vote, I don't know of one that I would trust with my wallet in their reception area.
One of the things you note in your series of articles, first of all, the remarkable glitches, again, the one where Deborah Clark just stuck 34,000 extra votes on the gambling initiative, which actually failed by 17,000. You note that County Hillsborough County, which had electoral voting, we touched on this last time, there was one town where 12,000 some odd people voted, but not one of them cast a vote for state attorney, yet countywide in Hillsborough County, some 118,000 some odd voters turned out to vote, and yet there were 125,000 votes in Hillsborough County for state attorney. Countywide, there are 7,000 more votes than there were voters, and yet this one town, strangely, not one of 12,000 some odd people who voted cast a vote for state attorney. Now, you don't have to be Albert Einstein or a computer expert to figure out that there's something very, very wrong with that.
Well, and what we haven't touched on yet is that the supervisor of elections, where all of these shenanigans have been taking place, is married to the regional manager for ES&S.
Okay, now tell us about Richard Clark and ES&S.
We got enough about Richard Clark, but I know enough to know that's an obvious conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I know enough to know that the shenanigans that you've just pointed to cannot be considered extraordinary because they've occurred in too many places, so we can no longer pretend to be shocked. I know enough to be able to tell you that practices that are that put a top Pentagon official in prison after she went to work for Lockheed after giving them a big contract happen regularly, daily, in the election services industry with no comment from either party. That the people, that the election services industry has been convicted of fraud and bribery, massive bribery, across the country and around the world. You can't go 12 months without something like this happening. So, and then you investigate, as I have begun to, the ownership of the election services companies themselves, and you find the most amazing things.
You know, there are a number of metaphors that come to mind for the relationships that you've detailed in your articles, none of which I can use on the air because they're all various slang terms for group sexual activities. But it's really what you've uncovered here, and it's I think as we look at the various companies, it's incestuous. Richard Clark was the husband, I guess still is the husband, of Deborah Clark, selected by Jeb Bush to oversee voting in Pinellas County.
Well, okay, now let's cut to the chase here. Okay.
Right.
Because what we've just talked about in Pinellas County occurred in Broward County. on a larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that's of interest to the 2004 presidential election because the UC Berkeley researchers who studied the Florida returns came back and said there were three counties where only the added factor of new electronic voting could account for what they determined were at least 132,000 or so extra votes for George W. Bush
mm-hmm.
that statistical analysis could not account for. And Broward County, and they did the same thing in Broward County on the gambling initiative. The supervisor of elections over there made another dumb mistake, don't you know, and reported totals on the gambling initiative that were counted that were like 100,000 votes off, 100,000 extra. I mean, and of course, none of this fraud ever occurs against a gambling initiative or for a Democratic candidate, except in those few enclaves where the Democrats, can resist the encroachments of the Bush cabal. Thank God there are a few still left, you know, but they're islands now, because this has been a massive, it's been a long-term effort, but I believe in the past 4 or 5 years it's become much more intense.
Oh, yeah. And now, real quickly, Dan, we're almost out of time on this side. I'm just going to quickly outline some of these relationships so listeners have an idea of who's doing what with whom. And, again, fill in the sexual metaphor of your choice there, I guess. Deborah Clark is selected by Jeb Bush to head up elections in Pinellas County. She opts to pick up machines from Sequoia that cost $14 million, but she says that we can't spend $2 million to provide a paper trail, to retrofit the Sequoia machines to provide a paper trail, because it's too costly. The punch card machines would have only cost $3 million, so there's an obvious discrepancy there. Her husband, Richard Clark, works for Richard A. Clark Enterprises, a consulting firm, but that firm has just one client, and that's ES&S, which is another one of these voting machines. You also note that Clark's deputy administrator, Karen Butler, in Pinellas County is the sister of Sandra Mortham, Florida's former Secretary of State, I would assume the predecessor for Catherine Harris, and a lobbyist for ES&S.
Right, so it's pretty obvious. Well, if you're closing out, let me add at least a little promo.
Mm-hmm.
I now have a young associate who's a lawyer and an MBA from Miami who's working with me on this. And so if any of your listeners out there are interested in buying any books or tapes, it would help support our research because we're not advertising supported except for the stuff that I do. So
real quick, give us the information about the website.
I'm not. It's madcowprod.com, or Madcow Morning News, or you can if you need an 800 number, it's 800-556-2012.
That's where to access the information. Recall, of course, that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs, including all of my interviews with Daniel Hopsicker, are available at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Long written detailed descriptions of the programs, as well as tons of other material and links on the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 494, another conversation with Daniel Hopsicker about electoral fraud. This has been recorded on January 9th of the year 2005. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.